hopefully I can say a few words about what that means from a Buddhist perspective, in my opinion, and a little bit drawing from the suttas and from the experience of confidence or faith or trust in my life and practice. But I wanted to start with a meditation, first of all, so that we are receptive and we can soften our hearts. Oh, and I will also speak up. I think I'm speaking fairly quietly. So I'll do my best. Yes.
There are
just
one
if you swap places. What if you swap places? Would you mind?
No, thank you.
No? All right. Just do a fairly short guided meditation with a few suggestions to help you settle and open your hearts to the idea of faith, what that might mean, how that might be experienced for you right now. So just allowing yourself to find the most comfortable posture possible for you. Perhaps by closing your eyes and really feeling into your body. Noticing if there are any parts of the body that could be adjusted to bring a sense of ease. Noticing if you are holding your breath at all, holding your belly in, or using any unnecessary muscles, or just invite those body parts to relax, invite the breath to be a little bit deeper, perhaps intentionally relaxing the out-breath to be that bit longer, and to relax as the breath leaves your body. Noticing that your body is held by the chair or the ground. You can allow the weight to sink into the chair, to sink into the floor, and feel held. Noticing the atmosphere around us, the presence of friendly people you may have just met or have known for a long time, but people you can trust have good intentions in being here, people with whom you can feel safe. At least imagine feeling safe with. Noticing that we are in a quiet place. And noticing our relationship to the silence, seeing if we can befriend the silence and invite her in. Allowing mind to rest in the spaces between the thoughts, between the sounds, the traffic. And connecting to the feeling part of the mind. Your direct experience, beyond anything you've read, anything that should or should not be present right now. Just opening to the way things are. Feelings that are in your body as you gently allow your awareness to soak down from the top of the head to the tips of your toes. Noticing any feelings, any physical sensations. The top of your head, around the skull. Scalp. Just receiving whatever sensations you notice right now, without ascribing any meaning to them, but just letting them be, letting them teach you. Noticing any feelings in your forehead and brow. Seeing if you can relax with those feelings without trying to change them or push them away. Sensing your cheeks, your mouth, your chin. Allowing your awareness to soak through your neck, deep into your shoulders. So you're just soaking in the warm, gentle rays of the sun. And that sunshine is illuminating whatever feelings, whatever experience is happening in your shoulders right now. Shedding light and also offering a sense of friendship and warmth. Spreading down through your arms, to your elbows, your wrists and your hands. See if you can notice, give attention to every finger, any feelings you experience on your fingers and fingertips. Sending them goodwill. And noticing how they respond. Noticing your chest. Allowing your awareness to spread through the upper chest. Receiving any sensations you notice as your awareness flows down through the chest, around the ribs, maybe deep inside. Just direct experience without concepts, without names. Your experience happening now. Giving attention to your tummy area. See if you can open up to the sensations around the belly. Maybe noticing your belly rise and fall. Starting from the upper back, allowing this kind awareness to shine on your upper back and spread, gradually down, including your spine, your upper rib cage at the back, your waist, your lower back, your hips. As though you were simply receiving the gentle rays of the sun. Sensing into your buttocks, noticing feelings in your buttocks right now. Perhaps heaviness or softness, pressure, numbness, whatever you notice, your direct experience beyond belief. Allowing the awareness to keep spreading through your thighs to your knees, picking up whatever sensations manifest right now. Just relaxing with them. Being kind to them. Allowing everything to be. And spreading this awareness through your lower legs, the calves, the shins, down to your ankles. Into your heels, perhaps noticing the contact with the ground if your feet are on the floor. Noticing the soles of the feet, the bridge of the feet, and right into your toes, allowing this kind awareness to spread to each and every toe, sending your toes goodwill, allowing them to relax. Just feeling the whole body sitting. With nothing to do. And then bring your awareness, the same kind awareness, to notice the condition of your mind. And see if you can bring to mind a quality you really respect in yourself. Maybe noticeable right now, or maybe some quality you're developing, nurturing in your life. Perhaps the quality of harmlessness, the intention of non-harm. Some quality that you really revere and have confidence in as something good, something noble, something worth cultivating in your heart. Maybe a sense of courage. Perhaps kindness. A willingness to admit your mistakes. Something that is noble, something that is beautiful, that you see inside or are developing, in which you can trust. How does it feel to reflect on this quality? What is the nature? Kindness, of harmlessness, of patience. See if you can sense that inside. And allow the reflection of this beautiful quality that's developing in your heart to bring gladness to your mind, to bring inspiration. Inspiration in the path. finally, if you wish, I'd like to invite you to bring to mind someone in your life or someone you know of who inspires you, who maybe manifests or embodies this quality, or any other quality that instills a sense of confidence, inspiration in your heart. Bringing them to mind. Maybe a good friend, a teacher, a religious figure. Someone who can encourage you and inspire you to continue developing the path, leading to peace, leading to more kindness, and any other quality you aspire to develop. Allowing your mind to rest as you bring up these beautiful qualities. Recognizing there is so much goodness in this person, this being, and perhaps, by extension, in the world. Now gently leaving any contemplation aside and just once again sensing into your body sitting. Noticing how you feel now. Whether there's more ease or not. More brightness or maybe sleepiness. Perhaps more spaciousness, more peace. Just noticing. If there are any effects of this short meditation, and how that manifests in your body and in your mind. Really appreciating any softening, any peace, any increase in mindfulness, instead of focusing on what you think is wrong. When you're ready, staying connected to your direct experience, keeping one eye inside, so to speak, you can gently open your eyes. And if you feel like smiling, you can smile. I wanted to talk a little bit about faith, which is a strange translation for what we call saddha in Buddhism, but it's one of the translations, and particularly faith from a Buddhist perspective. Because often when we talk about faith, we kind of think of it as something more associated with the kind of faith religions, you know, like Christianity or any other faith, really. Apart from Buddhism, which is very scientific, very rational, right? Doesn't require any belief, any faith. And yet, sometimes if we do dismiss the concept of faith prematurely, we are missing a great energy source, a great source of nourishment and sustenance and uplift for the mind. And whilst there are dangers to a blind belief in that perhaps it can make us a little bit naive, or maybe jump at a conclusion before we've really investigated the teachings or the nature of this life for ourselves. Perhaps it can also, you know, make us easy to manipulate or kind of draw us into a sect. So we have a little bit of fear around the idea of faith. And yet, in Buddhism, faith always goes hand in hand with wisdom. And I was just speaking to Lena earlier today about the way that it's often taught in the Buddhist teachings as something we need to balance with wisdom. So saddha is one of the five friends, or one of the five strengths of the mind that empower the practice. And it's the first one of those friends. And some people say, well, you know, you have to start with faith and then bit by bit, you know, it turns into wisdom. But that's actually not how it goes. Or they say that, you know, faith, if you have too much, it's not a really good thing, so you have to balance it with wisdom. But my understanding of the kind of saddha, is the Pali word, that the Buddha teaches, is that it always includes wisdom, right from the very outset. And yet sometimes there has to be enough confidence to at least take our first step. But the idea is to take that step and to investigate for ourselves. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this today is because I was recently teaching a retreat in Norway. Two of you were here there with me, Tanga and Casey came along. And it was a really beautiful retreat. We've taught it for the third year running now, together with another monk trained with me in Perth. And it's a beautiful setting, lovely mountains, and there are a lot of Dhamma teachings. And many people are coming to this retreat, actually, more or less for the first time. And one of my friends came along, and I think she hasn't done that many retreats, but she's had a life pretty much immersed in virtue, a very, very wholesome life. And she lives also an incredibly busy professional life, and also serves for Anukampa quite a lot. And so she came quite frazzled, but got really inspired and just let the tiredness be, let the restlessness be, and just took this back seat in observing her mind. And while she was doing this, she was also reading about meditation. And very, very quickly on this retreat, she started to go through some of the stages leading into the deep meditations of, like, deep samadhi, and also a lot of insights would arise. And it was so beautiful to see this progress, you know, just kind of taking shape. And at the end she came to me and she said, "It's possible." And she just had these big eyes full of wonder. She said, "It's possible." And she was almost in tears. And I said, I knew what she meant. I didn't know how to say what. It's possible. And she just said, it is. And I said, it is. It is, yeah. And I said, that is faith. That is the arising of confidence. And she said, is it really happening? Like, is this, am I just imagining these things? And I said, no, you know, these are real experiences that you're having. And she knew that because she was verifying her experience, checking it against the teachings of the Buddha, and, you know, and everything was kind of progressing just as it does when we take a back seat and start to let go. But it was just such a beautiful experience to see that she'd got this immense faith that, you know, it was possible to get enlightened. It's possible to do the whole thing. We don't actually do it, but it's possible for the Dhamma to have results. You know, when we practice properly, results have to come. Sometimes we put this burden of time on ourselves and we say, oh yeah, but I don't know if it's possible for me now or in this lifetime or in 20 million lifetimes. Who cares? It's not the point, right? It's really not the point. The point is we've got enough confidence to take a step, and we're taking that step, and we're able to get verifiable results. So this is how the practice works. We need enough faith in the beginning, enough confidence, to at least have something roused in us. Something kind of arises. We think, there's maybe something here. You know, that's why many of you are here tonight. You think, yeah, if I come to Peace House, not because it's called Peace House, but if I come there, maybe I'll learn something. Maybe there'll be some meaning for me. Maybe it'll help me in some way, right? So you have a little bit of preliminary faith, I would call it, enough to come and practice. And of course, I know many of you have been practicing for much longer, so you know why you're here. But the same process continues throughout the path. You know, one of the lovely translations that I think Bhikkhu Bodhi gives for confidence or faith is something like an openness, a willingness to take on faith or remain open to the possibility of something that we have yet to be able to verify through direct experience. So a willingness to be open or take on faith, something that we have yet to verify through experience. We're not able to verify it yet, but there's this sense that this is leading somewhere. There's something in this. And for me, when I first found the Dhamma, that kind of faith arose very, very strongly. I think it was there to take my retreat. The reality of suffering had hit. And I thought, there must be a meaning to suffering. There must be some kind of way to deal with this and some sort of something to understand from it, something to learn. And then when I heard the Buddha's teachings that there is a path and there is a way out of suffering, it just lit up such enormous joy in me. It was like, oh yes, I knew it. You know, I'm so inspired now. I'm never going to forget this path. I'm going to keep on cultivating it. And that was a kind of inspired confidence. You know, and the inspired confidence is kind of the second stage of faith in a sense. And it can still be very fragile at this stage, you know, especially if we put it in a person or in a technique, solely in a technique. And yet, you know, if it's informed by wisdom, if we understand we need to continue to allow it to mature, it can progress and mature into something that's more verified through our experience. And we can then check our experience in the practice with, and also our experience of what we read and what we learn from our teachers, with our experience in life. The Buddha's saying if we, you know, live in a kind way, if we have good intentions, if we treat each other with respect, you know, if we practice loving kindness rather than ill will, if we try and restrain our acts of body, speech and mind, then it will have good results. And we can start to see this in our lives. You know, the beauty of retreat is that you can see it almost instantly. A negative thought arises and you just feel bad. You know, it makes the mind immediately agitated, and you even start to get physical sensations that kind of start to resonate with that ill will. But when we do something good, it's a harmless act. We might not see the results straight away. So confidence does require patience. A lot of patience, a lot of trust. But over time, if we just keep on planting those good seeds, we start to gain confidence in this idea of cause and effect. And I think this is one of the really powerful kind of things that we can have faith in. You know, it needs to be placed in something One of the other definitions of sadda is something to place the heart upon or in. I think it was on the internet that I found another, it's from one of the dictionaries, that faith means to place or to put the mind, to place, or what was it? To rest the mind on something good and honourable. Yeah, so it's something we can rest the mind on. It feels good to contemplate kindness. It doesn't feel good to contemplate war and anger and revenge. It feels terrible, you know, when we start to go down that track. So it's something that we can actually take refuge in. But that refuge, when it goes deeper, the refuge is in our own acts of body, speech and mind. The Buddha defined kamma as actually volition. He said, chetana aham kammam vadami. It means like intention, I say, is kamma. Kamma is intention. That's where we're creating or planting the seeds for future effects. Yeah. So as long as we meet our experience with as much kindness and wisdom and clarity as we can be sure that bit by bit we're going to be, you know, coming out of suffering and moving towards a life filled with more contentment, more happiness, more peace. That's good for ourselves and good for others. The traditional place to place your heart or, you know, put your confidence in is actually the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. They're called the Triple Gem or the Three Refuges. And at a deeper level again, we were never being asked to put our faith in a human being. The Buddha was a human being, and that's amazing because it shows that enlightenment is possible for us. He was no different than us. He didn't have, you know, psychic powers when he was born. He didn't have kind of anything, any extra sense faculty or anything other than we have right here. We have a human body. We have all our sense faculties intact. If we can hear the Dhamma, if we can, you know, appreciate that, yes, there's some suffering in life and that suffering has a cause, and that it matters what we do, it matters how we treat each other. You know, this is going to lead to our happiness or misery right now or in the long term. Then we have everything it takes to practice the path. And so taking refuge or placing faith in the Buddha really means placing faith in our own potential for awakening fully. That means awakening to understand the truth of suffering and the cause and the end of that suffering completely. Yeah. So it's essentially faith in the path. Faith in the Dhamma means faith in the teachings. That means you're willing to give them a try, right? Basically, confidence is that thing that enables us to take the first step. Sometimes that takes courage. We maybe have to take a risk. We're not quite sure if it's going to be good for us or whether we're going to waste 10 days of our life by going on retreat. But we're willing to take a step because we've tried so many other things and they didn't work, be honest. Right? A lot of the time things work for a while and then the kind of gloss sort of fades and, you know, cracks start to appear, even in the best of relationships. If we haven't got something deeper underlying that relationship, some kind of meaning to it, some way to develop ourselves through it, then, you know, it's not going to solve the problem, the problems that we have in life. For that, we have to go inside. We have to start seeing where the problems are coming from, where the suffering is arising from, and how we keep fueling that through our delusion, through our unwise way of attending to our minds. And then the confidence in the Sangha means the confidence in the monastic community of people who practice well, but it also means the confidence in our own capacity, again, in the community of practitioners, in the fact that each and every one of us can do this. There's no exceptions to that. It doesn't matter what colour you are, what age you are, what kind of ability or lack of ability you think you have, physically or mentally. Sometimes we think, yeah, but my mind, you know, my mind's different. No, it's not actually. I've served, and Lena's served even more retreats, but I served on more than 60 retreats in the Goenka tradition. That was the big first 10 years of my practice life. And all over the world, you know, in small Indian villages where no one spoke, well, I didn't speak their language. It was a very minor Indian language, and all the discourses would be translated. And sometimes, you know, there'd be an interpreter as well. just all over the place. I've taught retreats, and believe me, the human mind is the human mind. Mm. You know, it's the same. There's a sort of spectrum. There's a range of suffering we can experience, but there's also a range of joy. And of course, our life conditioning changes, our situation varies massively. You know, right now, all of us are safe. We might not feel it psychologically, but we're physically safe. You know, there are situations which are far more dire than this. We don't need to be reminded of that, you know. Although it can be helpful to recognize the privilege we have and how not to waste time. But basically, you know, this practice works for everybody, regardless of who you are. It's just the simple law of cause and effect once again. And I think we were speaking today also about this idea of when doubts come up, and that sometimes we think, oh, I don't know really if things are working anymore, you know, maybe this is the wrong path, maybe I just don't have what it takes. But we can always say, well, what am I actually practicing here? I'm practicing sila, virtue. Can there be anything wrong with that? Can there be any adverse effects to practicing sila? I don't know. Has anyone experienced adverse effect? We can talk about it. You know, sometimes we think if we're too kind, we'll get walked all over or something like this. But that doesn't mean, you know, kindness doesn't mean a lack of boundaries. It doesn't mean you're not kind to yourself, right? Kindness and compassion extend to others as well as to ourselves. So practicing virtue is always a beautiful thing. And virtue can also say no. You know, it can be saying no to what is not virtuous, what is not skillful. So I think the more confident we get with our virtue, the more we can actually take a stand, we can speak up. We don't only not lie, but we speak out against injustice. We speak as allies for people who are oppressed. Yeah. And how can that really go wrong? You know, we're practicing virtue. It's universal. It's not sectarian in any way. We know, don't we, in our hearts whether something's wholesome or not. We can feel the results, sometimes immediately, sometimes over time. You know, if you're really doubtful, well, what are you doing on your cushion? You're trying to calm your mind. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? Okay, so the mind's still running like a wild monkey from branch to branch. Never mind. At least, you know, at least you're sitting quietly. At least you're sitting down. You're not speaking in an agitated way, you know. And bit by bit you start to notice there is silence in the mind. There is something underneath the thinking that's a little bit more real. You know, the direct experience that I was trying to point to by getting in touch with our feelings in the body, our experience that is something tangible, something we can feel. And then the last thing, we're trying to develop wisdom. These are the three aspects of the Eightfold Path. Virtue, serenity and wisdom. You know, we're trying to see the causes of suffering that we create for ourselves and others. By doing that, it's not that we're going to indulge in those causes. Luckily, there's some kind of mechanism in the human being that wants happiness. It recoils from pain. The human being recoils from pain and desires one's own happiness. There are many misguided ways to go about finding that happiness. But once we start to calm the mind, we see that more clearly. We see when we're going in the wrong track. And of course, faith or confidence is an antidote to doubt. It's the direct antidote to doubt. And doubt is one of what we call the five hindrances to meditation. It's that kind of sense of confusion, not really knowing why you're doing what you're doing, not really knowing if it's working, feeling somewhat lost. And in the suttas, that's likened to being lost in the desert. You know, not knowing which way to go, you're at a crossroads, or maybe you don't even see a road, I don't know, it's hot, you're parched, you've no idea where you can find water. And that's sometimes how life feels, isn't it? Okay, I'm going to lighten the mood by telling this silly story from Ajahn Brahm, which is of someone who actually was lost in the desert, and they were lost for days and days and days, probably weeks. I don't know. They get exaggerated the more he tells them. But I don't tell it that much. So, and, you know, this person is lost in the desert and they're getting very desperate. They're starting to feel dizzy and, you know, unable to keep walking. They're kind of going on all fours and in the distance they think they see something, you know, shimmering on the desert sand, but then they realise it's not water at all, it's just the mirage. And then beyond the mirage, suddenly they see something else and they see like a little kind of figure moving along, and then they realise, oh, There's a few little figures moving along. What on earth is that? Is someone there in the desert? Oh my goodness, someone's there. I'm going to be saved. And then this little entourage gets closer and he notices, that's really weird. It's a dog sled with the dogs, you know, the kind of huskies. And there's an indigenous, I don't know what you're supposed to call these people now. We used to say Eskimos, now?
Inuit.
There's an Inuit. Oh my gosh, and they're coming towards me. I'm saved. So he starts to get a little bit of courage and energy again, because that's what faith does, right? It gives you courage and energy and enough fortitude to bear the journey. And then finally they come to him. And he says, thank you, falls down and says, thank you. I'm saved. Can you please tell me how to get out of here? And you know what the Inuit says? And you think you're lost. So that's called the blind leading the blind. And this is the problem if we don't know who to trust, isn't it? The blind lead the blind. So this is what doubt can feel like. It took me years to realise that doubt isn't necessarily not understanding the teachings, or not necessarily even not thinking you can... You know, you can practice and make any progress. Sometimes it's just confusion in the mind. You're just kind of like, ooh, what do I do next? And that is the cause of many of the other hindrances, like restlessness, like jumping from branch to branch, you know, like a monkey. Or even tiredness. It's like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. There's no point even trying. Blah. I'm just kind of sunk, you know, in a soggy mess. So confidence is an amazing way to start undermining some of these hindrances and giving you the strength to sustain your practice even through the challenges which we have to face. You know, it's par for the course, and no one's going to be exempt from that. Until we're on the third stage of enlightenment, we're still going to have to work with greed and ill will to some extent. You know, it might not be outright anger, but there's still going to be that kind of grogginess, that kind of irritability of the mind. And having confidence gives us the patience to continue. It gives us the patience that this is something really meaningful here. So I did want to talk a bit about how we can develop more confidence in our life. I'm using the word confidence. It's my favourite translation for faith or sadhā. I actually like inspired confidence. But we could also call it trust. We could even call it, in a sense, devotion. I think I like inspired confidence because inspiration and devotion have this emotional element. And we need a bit of moisture in our hearts when we practice. Again, just taking that blind, rational kind of approach. Called it blind, didn't I? It's terrible. Scientific. But we can be blindly dogmatic with science as well. But taking that approach can sometimes be very dry. It's like, oh, I'm not going to do it unless it makes sense to me. You know. There's no joy in the heart. There's no sort of openness and faith and devotion and inspiration softens the mind to be receptive to the teachings. So how do we deepen this? How do we deepen it in a way that is going to bring about the kind of confidence that really helps the inquiring mind as well? You know, it doesn't just kind of fall on a conclusion before it really has all the evidence at hand. So what did I jot down? The first thing was, again, to take that step. Just to take a step. It doesn't matter. Sometimes these days, I don't know if it's the education system, we feel like we have to have the instruction manual in front of us before we try. I've noticed it in the monastery that younger generations, sorry to say, tend to want to sort of know what they're supposed to do before they try. And I think in my generation, I can say that now because I'm getting 50. So I've got a couple of generations now and a half. We used to just try stuff. It's called trial and error, like, I don't know, there's a sandpit and you play, you mess around, you make mistakes, you kind of, if that doesn't work, you try the next thing, if that doesn't work, you try something else. And this is really important in the Dhamma. You know, it's okay to make mistakes. So we just take that first step and then we check, what kind of results did that bring? It might have brought terrible results, and then you know for yourself. It might have brought good results, then that faith goes a little bit deeper. But if we already think we know, before taking a step. We've read all the suttas, we can quote all the texts, we can teach other people how they should meditate as well. That's actually missing the inquiry that helps to verify our faith. Right? We're landing on something before we've really understood through our experience, and it's our experience that's going to make the difference. Another thing is to reflect on the benefits of your practice. And that's what we did at the end of the meditation just now. We reflected, you know, like, how do I feel? How does my body feel? How does my mind feel now that I've brought up these reflections? It's okay if your mind feels tired, it feels confused, that's fine. But at least you don't have regrets, I hope. You haven't done anything unskillful in the last half hour or more, right? You've had really, really good sila for the last hour. So that's wonderful, and there may be a result that you can observe. One of the things I do in my Wednesday chanting sessions, this is a kind of outcome still of the corona pandemic, because during that time, as Isabel compassionately mentioned, I was all on my own in a rented house, and I knew that that would be quite lonely and it would maybe start to cause doubts to arise about the meaningfulness of my life as a monastic, you know, just being isolated, not really, you know, having much purpose. And so I decided instead to start this Zoom teaching. I'm atechnical, so that was quite a feat. But I was doing chanting weekly, metta meditation and a Dhamma talk every week. And it still continues, not quite in the same quantity, but we still continue the chanting. And to my amazement, people still come. The purpose was because a lot of people were losing family members or extremely worried about themselves or others during that time, also the NHS workers, etc., etc. And so we would hold people in our hearts and chant metta for them as a group. But it's still going on, and at the beginning, it's only half an hour. We chant for like 5 minutes, something like that, after all that we collect all the dedications. But I ask them how they are when they join the session, and they say tired, exhausted, a bit stressed, anxious, but happy to be here. The usual. And then I ask them at the end, so could you just write a word in the chat? How do you feel now? Serene, softer, more at ease, tired but mellow, harmonious, connected. It's just so beautiful to read this out. And I do that on purpose so they can hear it. Because I think we need each other to bounce off, to recognise that we are actually taking steps. And the steps we're taking are bringing real benefits that we can experience instantly. You know, who cares if we're going to get enlightened in this life? If we can feel really good in a wholesome way within like 15, 20 minutes, you know you're on the path. The Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi also has a lovely phrase. He said there's only two things needed to walk on the path, to reach the goal, to reach full enlightenment, okay? Full enlightenment. You think you've got to be clever or wise? No. You've got to start walking on the path. And you've got to?
Keep going.
Yeah, continue. That's it. That means circumnavigate all the obstacles and just have faith in the right intentions, in right view. So talk to each other, you know, also about benefits. And if you have doubts and confusions about the teachings, about your practice, talk to someone who has walked a little bit further than you. They don't have to be some kind of enlightened being or kind of great Tibetan Lama that's the reincarnation of such and such. The important thing is they've been practicing significantly longer, perhaps, not necessarily, than you. But their sila is really good. Their virtue is really strong, you know, and you've seen them. You've seen that they're not perfect, but they admit their mistakes. You know, they don't try to conceal things. They don't try to bend the truth. They certainly don't abuse others or, you know, manipulate other people or, you know, act cruelly towards anyone. And they're trying their best, you know, and they're honest about their practice. So talk to them. One of the best ways to overcome doubt is to talk to a teacher. And the Buddha also says if you ask questions, you'll be intelligent in your next life. So if you're not intelligent in this life, or if you didn't get into Oxford this time, but you might have been, then you can ask more questions and get into Oxford next time. That might not be, you might even get into a monastery if you really, no. So ask questions and clarify your doubts. And then another thing is wise association, very much related, right? But again, the Buddha said the whole of the holy life is spiritual friendship, and that's to make sure you really are on the path, you're really staying, you're understanding the Dhamma properly, and you're not going down kind of by roads and slip roads and dead-end streets. You're not getting too kind of obsessed with progress. You're not kind of equating progress with states of mind. All this kind of thing is so important. It can come up for anyone at any time. So we need each other to remind ourselves, to remind each other of the path. And we also, the Buddha says, you know, that wise friends are there to instruct, encourage, inspire, gladden, and emulate. I really like that because I learn through osmosis, and if I'm around kind people, I see how they behave. I'm like, wow, see that? When they work so quietly, not like me. They work so quietly and they're always present. And then you see the way they relate to others with so much humility, and it's like, wow. And being around them just changes your whole energy. It's amazing. So these are some ways, but I did want to leave time for some discussion. So just to say that it's very, very important and gives you a lot of strength and a stability and ability to face challenges in your practice when we develop confidence, when we develop faith. And we can find a love for the Dhamma, a love for the practice through that. It makes us empowered. We're not putting our faith in the hands of some god or some divine being who's going to do the work for us. The Buddha said, I can't do it for you. Each wise person has to do this for themselves. So it's empowering to understand that our actions are the cause of our happiness or our suffering, both now and in the future. That's incredibly empowering. And at any time, we can try to be kind. We can try to be harmless. We can be more gentle. We can cultivate contentment. So just look at your life, look at your practice and ask yourself, over the long term, you know, am I developing more peace? Am I becoming kinder? Am I cultivating more compassion? You know, am I developing wisdom? Is this practice helping me in my life? How do I know? Speak to your friends about it, get guidance, and keep on cultivating faith. So this is my little reflection for tonight. And I would love to hear from all of you as to what inspires you and how you keep the confidence alive. Yes.
I was some of the things you said about confidence and faith. Seems to me to overlap quite a bit with how I think I view or feel about curiosity.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you had thoughts on that.
Great. Yeah, can I read a quote that I wanted to read, but I think this is great. This is called One Who's a Preserver of the Truth. I don't know if it really relates, but I think it does. It's like how to get to the truth, right? You need curiosity. So somebody asks the Buddha, in what way is there preservation of truth? Because we all think we know, right? And then it's like we've got to preserve the truth. And in a way, that's the opposite of curiosity. How does one preserve the truth? Then the Buddha says, if a person has faith, they preserve the truth when they say, my faith is this, but they do not yet come to a definite conclusion. Only this is true and everything else is wrong. In this way, there is preservation of truth. In this way, we describe the preservation of truth, but as yet there is no discovery of truth. In other words, so as long as we don't know, as long as there's yet no discovery of truth at the realized level, at the actualized level, we have to maintain this open mind, this mind of curiosity that says, this is what I think, this is what I have faith in, this is what where my confidence is, but I'm not going to fall on what is true until there's an actual discovery.
Yeah, I think that's why I like that definition. of faith you kind of sort of approximate, because I think for me usually I have that skepticism about faith, and then I think I don't need that, I'm using curiosity instead.
Brilliant.
But the way you described it, it kind of like merged towards how I see curiosity, so
that
was quite nice
too. Yeah, great, because skeptical faith, skeptical doubt I suppose, rather than skeptical faith, can be an issue in that you don't even take a step. That's why it can be an issue. Mm. Like having enough, maybe preliminary confidence. I like that idea.
Yeah.
Just enough to take the step, just enough to inquire, to start that whole process of inquiring and investigation. Yeah. Curiosity is an amazing quality to have.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Can I speak as well?
Sure.
I think the Buddha talks about like everybody can get enlightened, and I think there is like a confidence issue with me for that. Like, I do believe there are enlightened beings in the world, so like even in the current age, I believe there are enlightened beings somewhere in Thailand or somewhere
in Thailand.
Somewhere in Thailand. Yes. I don't say a name, like somewhere in Perth, I think I just don't believe. I can't genuinely believe that I can get enlightened. Yeah. I do practice. I do feel like I have a lot of faith towards the Buddha and the teaching itself.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's like meditation. I speak the other day, it's like meditation for me is like painkiller. Like, because most of the time I feel very painful with a lot of things towards life. And then like meditation does not make me happier in certain ways, but like it certainly like it make me less painful. And it kind of like, if I didn't do meditation for that day, it's like I forgot to take my painkiller in some way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel like the not being able to believe that I can get enlightened sort of like limits my practice in certain ways.
That's actually a belief. So it's not that you're not believing you can get enlightened, you're believing you can't get enlightened. That is a belief. That's a blind belief. So the Buddha is saying you shouldn't come to any definite conclusion or belief when you don't yet know. So you don't yet know that you can't get enlightened. So hold an open mind and keep on practicing and notice which direction you're moving in. Because if you're moving towards peace, it's definitely a strange belief to believe you're not, or that it's not going to go somewhere. Does that make sense? It's a belief to think that you can't get enlightened. It's a blind belief. That's my little playful way to address the question right now.
But it's like the general feeling.
Yeah. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it really matters at this stage. The main thing is, are you getting more peace? Are you getting more harmony in your life? And I know you are. I know you enough to see that. Are you getting pain relief? That's fine. That's valid. That's totally valid. Are you sustaining your practice? Do you have enough confidence to take the next step?
What is the next step?
Being here? Being here is a step? That's enough for now. Coming back to the monastery? You're going to come back tonight?
Of course, I have nowhere to stay. You want me to sleep on the street? Oh no.
So that's the step. You're staying on the path.
Okay.
Not everyone stays. Some people might run away. You never know.
I do feel
Don't
like
run away. Yeah. Don't run away. Just keep going. But go gently. Go gently. Don't be in a rush.
Okay. Yeah, but maybe sometimes faith is just that you're, I mean, now in your, you make it look like figurative, but sometimes it's just you think like this technique doesn't work for me, and then you think about any alternative and you see there is no other way. Once you have sniffed out this Dhamma and you know you've sniffed it out, you don't really know, but you know there's no other way and you just have to keep going. And sometimes it's just that's what keeps you going, because you know there's just no alternative. And like you just don't have any other place to stay, you have to go back to the monastery. So it's the same with the path of Dhamma. I think once you have felt it, even if it's so difficult, you just have to keep going because you know there is no other way anymore.
Yeah, but like I know what it means, like, because there I also thought about the other day, because there are no other alternative, no other brands of painkillers for me.
Yeah. sometimes that's just good enough. Yeah.
That's good enough. That's good enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask a layperson this question? As in, did anybody except Buddha ever get enlightenment?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Okay, that's
In the suttas,
right.
I mean, there were countless, hundreds, even thousands of people who gained enlightenment in those days, and not only monks and nuns. That's why the Sangha is my favourite recollection, because, you know, there's four holy places in India. There's the place where the Buddha was born, there's the place where he got enlightened, there's the place where he taught the Dhamma, and then there's the place where he went into Parinibbana, final enlightenment, so he passed away and never came back. And my most holy place is the place where he taught the Dhamma, because it was at that place that he knew this was something that could be taught.
Is that Sarnath?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's the place where the first other person after the Buddha got stream winning, and then in the next sutta, five more fully enlightened beings came into the world. So that for me is the best place ever, because it's like if the Buddha would have got enlightened and that was the end of it, so what, you know, good for you, mate. You know?
And actually, I've been to Bodh Gaya, interestingly, so I'm kind of stuck in Bodh
Gaya. Sarnath to me is amazing, and I mean, it's continuing now. I mean, I've met people who are well on their way to enlightenment. That means they can't go back. They can't go backwards, you know, they're just going to go forwards. They've lost, they've overcome doubt. That's the final stage that I never got to. I have to verify faith. It's unshakable faith. The faith that just knows. It's absolutely wisdom imbued.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So because somebody's seen the Dhamma, they can't unsee
it
again.
You can feel it when you talk to them.
You can, because they don't relate to you from a sense of self.
Yeah.
And they don't relate to you as a self. They relate to you with compassion and without judging or fixing you in any way. And it's really remarkably freeing. It's deeply inspiring to meet these people. I've met people in Myanmar, and I don't know about Thailand, probably. And I won't mention any other place. So, and I think, you know, as long as, for me, the more I practice, the more confident I am that the path leads in that direction. It's less relevant whether how far I get on the path, because that's just the sense of self that thinks I have got to do it, you know. But the main thing is that the practice will lead in that direction. And so it gives a lot of freedom when you can just relax and say, never mind when, I'm just doing my best and I'm just going to continue anyway.
Yeah.
It makes you confident to take things on, you know, and to do things that are difficult because you know you're coming from a good place.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrible if you think it's something really difficult that you've got to really, really try.
I know, and that's the thing, when there's faith and confidence, it enables you to just surrender to the process and to let go a little bit and not to think you've got to use will and force and, you know, strive for any particular state of mind or any particular experience, because you just know, well, it's good enough if right now I'm making peace with my experience. That's all I need to do.
Absolutely.
So it helps the letting go.
You know, it feels interesting to hear you say how meditation. It feels interesting to hear Gloria talk about what meditation means to her, because to me it's somewhat opposite. before I tried to learn meditation, I kind of felt that I was doing quite well in life, but it's by learning meditation that I realized I actually have a lot of restlessness and sadness and heaviness in me. The reason I first got inspired by Buddhism was because of reading a book, and that's one paragraph of the Buddha explaining himself, and I felt very inspired by it. And I also heard that, well, if you need real insight and wisdom, you need deep meditation, so that's why I try to learn meditation. But then I keep, like, I felt it's really difficult for me, and I felt like, oh no, like I can't get any deep insight.
Do you want me to, is it a question?
Yeah,
I suppose it's doubt again, isn't it? It's doubt. It's kind of, I think generally on the spiritual path or in anything in life, we kind of forget that there's a process. It's like if you went to uni in Oxford, which you did, and you're in the first year and you think, oh, I can't get the degree because I'm not, I don't have the knowledge that that's needed to pass the degree. Mm. Well, of course you don't, because you're in the first year, you're not in the third year or the fourth year. Mm. So we're looking too far ahead of ourselves.
Mm.
The main thing, and you don't know what's coming or what's not coming, it's not up to you.
Mm.
But what you can see in your practice is whether it's now helping you. And whether you want to continue, and if you do, that's because you are getting results. I think it's so important to stay in the present and to stay grounded in our direct experience. And it's through understanding the mind more deeply that we start to see where we're hindered. There's nothing like an ability or a lack of ability. If there's a blockage, it's one of the five hindrances, or sometimes three or four or five. Remember on the retreat in Norway? It was really funny because the other teacher taught on the five hindrances and used the similes of craving is like being having a debt, and ill will is like being sick, tiredness and lethargy or sloth and torpor is like being in a prison, is it? Yeah, restlessness is like a slave, and you know what doubt is? It's been lost in the distance and seen an Eskimo. No. And then somebody wrote in the comments, today I learned that I am a sick slave with an enormous debt in prison in the desert. It was brilliant. In other words, they had all five hindrances, and I'm like, no, not possible. You can't be drowsy and restless at the same time. I mean, sometimes it goes quickly, you know, but the more we start to see, diagnose the obstacles, in a sense, and we also realise they're conditioned, right? They're not fixed. They're not always there. They're always changing, and there's causes, just like for everything else. Then we realise it's not actually, it's just a matter of learning to work skillfully with those things. Yeah, there's nothing actually preventing anybody in this room gaining the kind of insights that will bring a lot of relief. It can feel, I mean, everybody's path's different. It can feel like you're making no progress for years and then someone has an insight, or some people get a lot of benefits in the beginning and then there's a lot of grueling work to be done, or, you know. But the main thing is kindness ever wasted? You know, is anything other than benefit to come from calming the mind? It has to have good effects.
I think at least I'm understanding myself a lot better than before.
Great. It's not a small thing, you know. I mean, imagine how many people in the world never have a chance to sit down and try and understand themselves. Even if they have a chance, there's no teachings or no teachers around.
Yeah.
It's not a small thing. I don't know how anybody else feels. I mean, what about the more experienced people in here? You must have gone through doubts.
I wouldn't put myself down as being more experienced anymore. But I suppose for me, it feels a little bit overwhelming thinking, you know, one day there's this path, I'll get on it, and then I'll have enlightenment.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, that... when I was really released when I realised that actually everybody's on a path in one way or another, and this thing called nirvana or enlightenment or whatever comes and it goes, it comes in glimpses, and I suddenly found myself thinking, and I found that in meditation, when I realised that about 90% of my meditation was I was distracted in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a release, actually, because all the other, the earlier meditations, I kept doing a sort of test, well, how was that? And actually, it's a bit better than the last one, and all that. And then when I suddenly was released from it and thought, that was a lovely moment, yeah.
Yeah.
Bring it back. And it's the same I've found in life, really. You know, there's just seeing opportunities for kindness and to be kind and noticing it. And just celebrating that. There's a lot of unkindness in the world. And, I guess if I spend too much time with that unkindness, I lose sight of the other. And you know, all I can say is for myself is I've found a great release in letting go of this idea of I just haven't quite found the path yet.
That sounds great. Sounds really good. It reminds me of this attitude of practicing to give, not to gain.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just practicing to see what we can get and how we can feel better. We're practicing to kind of give. And if we think of our meditation as just an act of kindness, you know, or it's like a way of revering our teachers, or just a way of, I don't know, removing ourselves from a loaded situation, maybe. We're just doing it to give. Because it's a good thing to do, and the same with the kindness. I think, you know, I guess when we're younger we're more idealistic, but as we get older we're just grateful for such small things in a way. And we realise they're not small things. Yeah, like acts of kindness are amazing when there's so many other ways we could be and react. It's like, I just find it amazing that there are people in this world doing so much good. I'm just thinking of the monk, I think I mentioned it at the day retreat, the monk from the Oxford Buddha Vihara, who's mostly in Myanmar, but he lives in a complete war zone. And he has all these monasteries where, Buddhist universities actually in monasteries as well. And he's changing the education system from the inside out to bring about more student-centred learning and to kind of debunk the causes for this military regime. It's really amazing, and he says his main practice is mudita, and this is somebody who's living around so much stuff he could focus on as being really unjust, really devastating, and his main practice is to just rejoice in the goodness. I find that so amazing, and that keeps him strong. Yeah.
I found that so inspiring about him. Yeah.
Isn't it?
Absolutely, and made me think I'm doing much more joy practice now.
Ah, good.
As a result of
excellent.
Yeah, if you can do it in an actual war zone,
I know.
You know?
Makes it very real, doesn't it? It's not like, oh yes, I focus on all the good things in my life, well, good for you, you've got everything.
Yeah.
You don't know real suffering, but he knows suffering.
I had a question just sort of... made me think of how often it feels like, even if you have faith or curiosity or whatever, sort of, I think of it as, and you see the benefit that practicing can give us in life, how it can sometimes feel very incompatible with doing all the other things that you feel are very important. And the work in the war zone made me think, like, well, he's able to do so much good and build things and really improve the world in an outward-focused way, where meditating and going on the path can just feel quite self... Uh-huh. It feels very much sometimes selfish when there are so many things to be done around. Yeah. But, I guess there's examples like him, but how to, and very early stages, how to sort of
couple it with faith. I'm not quite sure what you mean by how to couple that curiosity with faith.
I guess there's incompatibilities.
Right, okay. Yeah. I suppose to start to maybe observe the direct relationship between meditating and giving, meditating and serving, because I think we can just give so much more when we're resourced. And I see for myself, if I'm kind of skipping meditations and if I'm getting kind of bogged down by too much work, I might still be doing the same thing, but I'm certainly not as effective and it's not as helpful. Whereas when I'm more resourced and, you know, I'm developing kindness and compassion and, you know, by addressing those causes that I see that the problem in the outside, I'm addressing those things within myself, that I'm far more resilient when I face those challenges externally. I mean, one of the things that brought me to the Dhamma was just seeing all the issues in the world, like the news and the wars and the poverty and this complete injustice of especially capitalistic society, basically, well, the whole world, really. And thinking, gosh, the cause must be greed and power. I want to uproot that in myself. I mean, I can't change other people, but if I can take that out of myself, then I'm not going to contribute to that situation. And of course, when we can address those things in ourselves, it also gives us more compassion for the people that have those things. So we're not coming from a place of anger, a place of kind of us against them, trying to, you know, show other people what's right. But we're actually kind of more resourced and also more compassionate, I think, towards the people that we try to serve. Because certainly, I mean, this monk I'm mentioning has deep practice, you know, and he stays very present and very focused when he is on his own. I think even when he's talking, he's very present. And it's remarkable. You wouldn't know he had so much on. Yeah. Does that help at all? Is that sort of way?
It's sort of like increasing capacity for the other things.
So. Yeah, and noticing how it does. I think that's where the faith will develop, you know, that you're not wasting your time in meditation. I mean, of course, meditation can go the other way and you can start to get like, oh, I actually don't feel like I want to go out and get away from this peaceful state. And then that's also a sign that might not be going the right way. Or it might be okay for a while in your practice, but if that continues and continues, that's not, it's not developing compassion, it's getting attached to peaceful states. So I think noticing the difference. But yeah, it's okay to take time for retreat. Yeah, no one can just work around the clock helping others. It's impossible. Yeah, you have to have compassion for yourself. Yeah. Thank you for all your beautiful contributions. And, for inviting me here. It's been really nice, actually, to be with everybody and to talk about something that I actually really love. So, the tiredness kind of dissipated a little bit, and the joy came up through the subject, so I hope you all feel good too. Should we sit for 1 minute and just quietly to end? Go well, stay well, keep practicing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.